This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
All right, joining me right now is actually one of my favorites to talk NFL and draft. We had Thor on about a month ago. Thor Nystrom with Fantasy Football Weekly. You can follow Thor on X on Twitter at ThorKu, T-H-O-R-K-U. So let's get right to it. How do you think Washington did?
I think, and good to join you, Kevin. I think Washington had a solid draft. You know, last year was the smash draft, obviously, for Washington. This one was more solid, I would say. But you hit a bunch of your need points, and I ended up grading on my curving methodology that I do with the draft grades. I ended up grading Washington with a C plus, above average for the NFL for their draft class.
All right, so why C plus?
I think the values in the slots were solid, but not outrageous, right? Like, and so because of that, you know, you're ticking off your needs, but this was more of a keep the ball in the fairway sort of a draft for Washington. And in terms of that, I thought they did well.
All right. Of the five players they took, who did you think was the best value pick?
Definitely Trey Amos. You know, at the end of the process, there was a bunch of media people pushing him as a late first rounder. I wasn't quite on board with that, but I had him 43 overall on my board. To get him at 61, especially when you would have skewed the boundary corner need in round one, to get that guy there, I mean, that's just fortuitous. So they had to be thrilled with that.
One of the things that I love that you do every year with your top 500 prospects is you give a pro comp for every player. So tell everyone who Trey Amos reminds you of.
He reminded me a lot of A.J. Terrell coming out of Clemson. And for that reason, you know, A.J. Terrell ended up going a little bit above this, but you have the very similar tall, angular outside cornerbacks that can get their hands on you and press coverage off the line. Polished players as well. There's a little bit of hip stiffness there and the lack of elite high-end speed, but very, very good players and physical outside corners who are well-built.
Before we get to the other four players, we've talked a lot about this week. They did not get a player at a need position that was very deep, at least according to, you know, all of you guys heading into it, and that is they did not pick an edge defensive end. A, were you surprised? B, was there any point in the draft where you thought they should have?
I was surprised-ish, but circumstantially, when you get into each stop along the train station that they had, it makes a lot more sense. You know, for instance, round one, two guys they wanted, Shamar Stewart and Mykel Williams, I'm pretty sure, for that. Those guys were long gone by that point. You're talking the two-way edge defenders that can also defend the run. Washington was not interested in doing business again with another one of those one-trick pony edge rushers that piles up pressure and sack numbers, but you cannot trust them to hold their ground on the edge and set the edge and play team run concept football in your run defense. So because of that, those guys are gone. You end up doing the tackle thing, projected long-term starter. Now you can kick Coleman inside. That plays up his game too. And then you get to the second round. The guy there that I would have advocated for where they were picking is probably Landon Jackson. I thought he fit what they were looking for pretty well. However, Trey Amos, just as good of a value. They're probably even a little bit better of a value. And then, of course, as you know, after the 61st pick, they don't pick again until 128. And by that point, those edge rushers were gone. You had to do it with one of those top two picks, or else it was going to be like a physically limited grinder there. You know, that you weren't going to be guaranteed could hang on the roster if you ended up taking one with the day three picks. So that's why that ended up happening. It was just circumstance, the way the board fell.
I never thought there was a chance for Williams in the first round. I actually thought there was a chance that Shamar Stewart would drop to 29, but I'm interested in why you think they would have been interested. I mean, the lack of production at the college level, I know the measurables were off the charts. He obviously went 17 to a team that also has a need, especially given the Trey Hendrickson situation. We'll see what happens there. But did you like Shamar Stewart as a prospect?
I saw Shamar Stewart as a prospect basically the direct inverse of the way that everyone else in the media did. You know, he was forwarded as this high ceiling but sort of risky prospect. And if you came in, you just shined it, then you would have a shot to get a gem there. I didn't see him as that high risk but high ceiling type prospect. I saw him as a high floor, lower ceiling prospect. And the reason for that is the one area of his game that we know we're getting in the NFL, he's an awesome run defender. Awesome run defender. I believe he was 97th or 98th percentile PFF run in run defense, positive graded run plays the last 2 years. Very, very good at that. That thing that Washington was looking for as far as setting the edge and playing team run concept football with their run defense, that's what Shamar Stewart gives you. The thing with the pass rush, that I don't know if that ever comes around. You're alluding to it. 4.5 sacks over 3 years, and people around my neck of the woods, I'm coming to you live from Minneapolis right now. Shamar Stewart was in, he was in discussions for the Vikings as well. You know, as far as if he got there, you didn't have the offensive line that you wanted, maybe you go with Shamar Stewart. And a lot was made about evoking him to Daniil Hunter, another edge rusher who had come out of the SEC, and Daniil had fallen down a bit because he accrued 4.5 sacks over 3 years in college, just like Shamar Stewart had. But with Daniil Hunter, you had a much, much higher pressure rate in college, and you had the projectable traits as a pass rusher. Shamar Stewart, he is historically freaky, his athletic profile, the size, and the north-south. Right, that's the testing that he did during the pre-draft process. He got the perfect 10 RAS. People forget, though, he ducked both the agility drills. You have the north-south load there, and you have the projectable frame. You have the versatility along the line. The east-west stuff and the suddenness with that, I think that in part explains why you have not seen the elite pass rusher to this point. You know you're going to get an elite run defender there. And I think you're going to get a worker bee type in pass rushing. I do not ever see Shamar Stewart becoming some elite pass rusher. I think that's more a really, really solid cog in your starting lineup for years, as opposed to the potential star that he was forwarded as.
Yeah, the motor was great, but what you just described in the agility drills that he ducked is what you saw on the field. Like, you saw a guy that didn't have great ability to sort of feel his way to the quarterback. He's like a straight line track athlete more than anything else, but the strength in the motor made him a good run stopper. And you know, you nailed it in terms of what Washington actually really needed heading into this offseason. More than anything, they got gashed on the ground last year. That was their problem. You know, they got good pressure. You know, they had Fowler Jr. end up with 10.5 sacks. They couldn't stop the run. So I that's interesting perspective. You know, I didn't think that James Pierce Jr. was even on their board, and my guess is that he wasn't because of some of the, you know, red flag stuff. That, to me, was fascinating. Do you think Atlanta needed to trade and what they traded to get up to pick him in the first round?
I was stunned by the price that our friend Terrible Terry Fondo paid in that trade. Yeah, and stealing from the future in an attempt to save your job, I think there's a decent shot that Terry Fondo is not going to be around for that future he was stealing from. Do I think they need to pay? No, I don't. Jacksonville, they paid their next first-rounder next year in order to move up to get Travis Hunter. Now, that was earlier in the draft, and it's a smaller move up, but like the margins at that point are much higher. We didn't see another first-round pick get traded. So for that to be the Atlanta gave up, I believe, the 47th slot too. So they, you know, you're moving up roughly 20 slots. Do I think James Pierce ends up falling to 47? No, but the urgency there, I totally agree with you. Washington wasn't picking him. That wasn't the need of Washington, even outside of the stuff that you hear about him in the locker room. You know, some people they don't have a great feel for him as a teammate. I don't think it's, you know, as far as like off field stuff that's more acute than that. I didn't hear that stuff, but it's stuff about just, you know, is James engaged here and stuff like that. And then the one trick pony guy with the pass rush, it just was not what Washington was looking for. So, yeah, but beyond that, terrible Terry, just, yeah, he paid through the nose for that.
They really liked Connerly Jr. They stood pat and they took him. What did you think of Josh Connerly Jr. at 29 in the first round?
I like the pick in terms of circumstantially where you're at. I felt like that was a fine audible. If you know, if we think that 2A run defending edge would have been the top of their preference list, the audible in this direction I thought made a lot of sense. And I understand why Washington didn't trade back, right? Because at that point you have Connerly Jr. there, and then you have Josh Simmons, who ended up going with the last pick of that round. After those two guys, the tackle class fell off an absolute shell.
Right.
So if you wanted to address that, it had to be with one of those selections there at the very end of the first round. So they just weren't in a position to bail out to round two, because then you're going to have to go with another position and eschew the offensive tackle position in this class.
You know, Peter said, Thor, that the offers included offers where they would have barely moved back at all. I think Kansas City perhaps was one of those teams that was looking to get to 29. And I just wonder, would they have taken Simmons there, or would they have taken Connerly Jr.? Because he literally said, Peter said, we barely had to go back that much, but we just thought that Connerly Jr. wouldn't be there if we had traded back at all. I'm wondering if the Chiefs had targeted Connerly Jr. and wanted to get to that spot to take him.
Certainly a possibility, Kevin, and obviously Kansas City was in the 31 slot at that time.
Yes.
We also know the Eagles were attempting to move up, and they ended up doing so just the one slot with Kansas City. But let's say that it's the Eagles, right? And let's say it would be back to 32. You know the Eagles aren't going to take the offensive tackle, but then you have the one other slot, and then you know that Kansas City will. And you have the two there. Presumably the fear is, it's not just, you know, obviously they prioritize Connerly over Simmons, but if they were close enough where they would have been cool with one or the other, the issue potentially there is, what if another team hops up with the Buffalo slot and all of a sudden they take one of those offensive tackles, and then you're just out in the cold? I mean, Houston was a team that was lingering there that we knew was sniffing around those offensive linemen. They had traded back to 34. That would have been one of the possibilities. Potentially Seattle there at 35, teams considering hopping back up into the first round. So, yeah, you would have been taking a big risk if you dropped to the end of that round, because it could have gone bang, bang right in front of you. Now you're left out in the cold again. You have to audible to a tertiary position now.
All right. Of Washington's other three players selected, Jalen Lane, the receiver out of Virginia Tech, Kane Medrano, the linebacker from UCLA, who actually looks more like a safety at times, and Kroski Merritt, the running back from more New Mexico than Arizona, because he only played one game at Arizona. Give me your thoughts on those three players, and then which was kind of the best value based on where they were taken?
In terms of value, my favorite one probably would have been Kroski Merritt, who I did feel should go above that and would have gone well above it if the NCAA wasn't ludicrously punitive with him. That was one of the most ridiculous eligibility things that I've seen in a couple of years, but we'll get back to him. Starting with Jalen Lane, the athleticism, it jumps off the screen. That's what obviously an undersized receiver, but the athletic profile, you just look at the measurables, the athletic test, the frame. The most similar guy in the NFL to him is Tyreek Hill, just from that perspective. Now, we got to do some work with his game, of course, but the explosion speaks for itself. I think initially, when he sees the field on offense, you're looking to manufacture him touches short, maybe out to the beginning reaches of the intermediate area, hit him in space, hit him on hands in space, and then let him run. That's going to be it initially, and then you just see where you can go beyond that. You mentioned the special teams utility and the return utility. I think we're going to see some of that as well. So I do like that player. And for Washington, that was the sort of guy that you're looking for to help out with that wide receiver core. Kane Medrano, he is fun. Kane Medrano is super fun to watch. To your point, he does sort of exist on this line between safety and linebacker. And he's this water bug of a linebacker who is always around the ball.
Yep.
He triggers really fast, and then the movement, the initial first couple steps, explosive downhill, and he flies around. He plays fearless. Love that. Love watching that. He misses all kinds of tackles. When he's always there, like I said, mucking things up, but when he gets on the doorstep, a lot of times he comes in too hot. He has a smaller tackle radius. He must get better breaking down when he gets on that doorstep as opposed to just flying in like a bat out of hell. That's where he ends up slipping off guys and not getting the best of it as far as the on-target tackle attempt. But a very interesting ball of clay there, and I think you can work with him a little bit on those tackles. I don't think you're ever going to be able to completely mitigate that issue because of the lack of play strength and then the smaller tackle radius. But you know that he's always going to be around the ball. So if we can just clean that up a little bit, we'll keep more fish on the line. And then lastly, Krosky Merritt, just the situation last year, that it was heartbreaking even to watch from afar because this is a kid who came up from New Mexico and made an inspired decision in the transfer portal. You go and you join a team that had Noah Fifita at quarterback, and then, of course, Tetero McMillan, one of the best receivers that we had in America. And what they needed was a running back to replace the guys who had gone into the draft the year before, Michael Wiley, and then one other kid. Well, anyway, Krosky Merritt comes in. He gets to play that one game. The eligibility issue was over a number from the year before where, like, one other guy in the roster had appeared in a game when he was, or during the redshirt year. It was the most ridiculous eligibility thing ever. So it was like they opened up an investigation to look into it. Then they never got back to him. So they literally just stole his last year of eligibility that was something that had absolutely nothing to do with Ja'Cory Krosky Merritt. He ends up falling here to the seventh round. If he had been able to play last year, I think you're talking minimum fifth round, maybe fourth round, maybe even the back end of the third, depending on how well he plays. He certainly would not have been available in round seven. The thing that you don't get with him, it's passing game utility. We just haven't seen it. So that stuff is all sight unseen, but a very natural runner that makes people miss. I love the way that he moves and that suddenness side to side. You see a lot of guys who we were talking about whiffing on tackle attempts. You see Ja'Cory Krosky Merritt set a lot of guys up to fail at that point. So it's a guy that I think is a mix and match guy for Washington. I think he makes a lot of sense and he's got a lot of natural running ability.
Whose draft did you like the most?
The two I liked that I gave my A-plus to do this year was the Giants and the Ravens. So we had one team that is always around that range and then one that never is.
Right. By the way, Baltimore usually is and the Giants usually are not. So with Baltimore, specific to Mike Green, I mean, I guess it's the organization that isn't concerned and will take chances on players with character issues. But did we ever find out specifically, was he just off boards across, a slew of many teams that had a need at that position?
That's what I believe it is. Yes, there are some teams that will take you off for the specific things that they were looking into with him that had to do with the circumstances surrounding his departure from Virginia.
Yeah.
There are teams that will take you off the board for that. Howie Roseman was a guy who earlier this process made a real point to say, we will not put on our board guys that have had issues with females in the past,
right,
that sort of the domestic type stuff. Howie's not the only one. Some of those teams don't come out and say that publicly, but we have several, and obviously that is the reason that Mike Green starts to fall. Those concerns ended up being more problematic for the NFL than was reported during the process. I was hearing more about that stuff back with the Senior Bowl, and then it just sort of went away. And so there wasn't as much reporting on it, and I thought that was because the NFL, when looking into it, had perhaps become more comfortable with it, at least their view on it, and going forward that wouldn't be an issue. But as you saw on draft weekend, there was a bunch of teams that indeed were concerned by that.
The Giants draft, so you obviously loved Abdul Carter, but you were okay with them moving into the first round to take Jackson Dart?
I was. That was probably their decision that I was, of all of them, that I would have been relatively lowest on, but I didn't have the biggest issue with it because they didn't pay through the nose. It wasn't like the Terry Fontenot situation with the first-round pick next year. I think the third was what they tossed in. But, like, with the trade charts, that was a fair trade. I had Jackson Dart 41st on my board. They ended up taking him 25th. But I see what they're seeing there. And if they can just the black box of Jackson Dart's evaluation, if they can address that, he's going to be good in the NFL, and they will have gotten him at a steal of a price point. And what that black box is, it's the reason I had to knock him down, it's a concerning sort of a black box in evaluation for a quarterback heading into the NFL, which is, we haven't seen Jackson Dart making decisions after the snap, by and large. It's the system that he played in for Lane Kiffin. Yeah, you get the pre-snap reads for you, and a lot of times it was going to that first read. Very rarely, certainly the third read. He started going to the second read just a little bit more last year, but the second or third read, depending, was always tuck and run, right? Like if he got to the second one, that one wasn't there, okay, we're tucking. And sometimes it was just, all right, the first read's gone, we're tucking. That reminded me of Sam Howell's last year at UNC. As you remember, Kevin, heading into that last year at UNC, Sam Howell was in the top five every single too early mock draft that you would see around the industry. And that last year, you saw in the Phil Longo offense, when he didn't have the first read there, it was always tuck and run. And so your concern had to be this guy going across the progression line. We just haven't seen it. That's my, you know, concern-ish with Jackson Dart, but it's not, I'm not saying he can't do it. It's just a black box. So the Giants, obviously, they feel that they can get him there. What we can say for Jackson Dart is he runs whatever system he's in very, very well. That's the thing that sort of reminds you of Bo Nix. I was one of those people that undersold Bo Nix last process, because while he ran that system really well, there were some aspects of it that were not translatable to the NFL, so they became a black box of his evaluation. Turns out that Bo Nix could do some of those things that were, you know, existing inside of that black box. We're going to find out with Jackson Dart.
Bringing up Sam Howell, by the way, you're a Vikings guy, you're a Minneapolis guy. Are you surprised that that's who Kevin decided to go with as a backup to McCarthy?
I'm not, because the acquisition cost and then what you got back for it was just such a good deal. What ended up happening on day three on Saturday, Kwesi Adolfo-Mensah, the GM for the Vikings, ended up turning the 142nd pick overall, which is in the fifth round. He ended up turning that into Sam Howell and then picks 201 and 202. And in addition to that, you essentially also acquired $9 million in salary cap flexibility this year between what you will be paying Sam Howell and what everyone was projecting that you were going to pay out for the 1 year of your veteran backup quarterback, right? $11, $12 million, whatever that would have been. You saved that now. That is equivalent to signing a starter at another position. So I just thought that whole thing was slick. The Vikings, you know, all the stuff with the veteran, you know, first it was Sam, then it was Aaron Rodgers, and they're going to sign Joe Flacco or Drew Locke or all these different things. This was the best course of action as far as the acquisition of that player for what it costs and then what it ends up saving you on both sides.
Real quickly, just back to the Giants, and I get accused of pumping up their roster minus the quarterback in recent years a bit too much, but, you know, defensively, if Carter's the real deal, if Darius Alexander can participate as a rookie in an early third-round pick, they have a tremendously talented defense. Do you agree?
Totally agree. Yeah, they got some monsters there, and I'm really interested to see how they fit in. If they keep the, you know, if Thibodeau is on that roster in the fall, I'm curious to see the mix and match they do. Will we see any of Abdul Carter off ball, right, and get all three of the guys on the field at the same time? Abdul Carter, obviously, prior to last season at Penn State, was an off-ball linebacker. So could you get some of that mixing and matching? I'll be very curious. But, yeah, can we get some creative sort of alignments where you get all those guys on the field?
You know, one quick thing, because you mentioned just sort of the one-trick pony on some of the edges. Did you view Donovan Azaraku as a one-trick pony at 245 pounds?
I didn't totally know, because he does do cool stuff in the run game. It's not your traditional set the edge guy, but he's a guy that I think of as pulling the pin out of grenades. He got into the backfield really quickly on some of those running concepts and just entirely blew the play up. So I didn't see him as the negative in the run game, maybe that some others did, but it's not exactly what Washington was looking for, so, you know, as far as that goes. So I understood that decision.
All right, last two. Give me your, you know, pick that you thought was the greatest value, you know, where the player was selected, that you're really excited about because you were, you know, building up before this draft started and somebody got a steal.
I would say if Will Johnson is healthy, that is the cornerback for Michigan. Yeah. That is an amazing value at 47 for Arizona. We just don't know about the medicals. And the concerning thing there, Schefter reported the fall was because of a knee injury. Will Johnson had multiple other lower body injuries to other lower body parts, like in the past calendar year. So it's like that one in conjunction with that, I understand why the NFL got trepidatious about that. But this is a guy who was a lockdown boundary corner on the 2023 Michigan Wolverine team that won the title. You look at his QB rating on his targets was just absolutely minuscule. The ball production there was was incredible. So if he is right, that is going to be a really, really good pick. And then I have to say it, Shedeur Sanders. The fifth round, there is no risk anymore. And so, like, it did seem like the NFL en masse was sort of standing up and making a statement to the Sanders and to Deion and to Shedeur. But at that point, you get into the fifth round, there is no risk anymore. So Shedeur Sanders is immediate. You never see a situation where a fifth round pick is clearly the most gifted quarterback on his NFL roster as a rookie. That's the case that we have here. And is he going to show up there defiant? In which case, he's probably going to be out of the league pretty quickly. That's the messaging that the NFL seemed intent on delivering over the weekend. Or is he going to show up humbled by this and get to work? Because if he does, I think you're going to see a fifth round rookie quarterback starting in the NFL this fall.
You know, for me, Thorne, we talked about this on the show yesterday. It's really simple. It was teams didn't see him as a first round quarterback. And once that became a reality, the juice wasn't worth the squeeze to select him as a low end starter or a backup with the three ring circus that would accompany it. And I just think that ultimately, there were probably teams that understood that the value on this player was much higher than the fifth round. But are you going to bring the circus to town for a low-end starter or a backup in terms of their evaluation?
For sure. Yeah, I would agree, you know, as far as the equation, that seemed to be what was happening when he wasn't like the top half of the first round pick. Yeah, you know, you get later on there, then you're going to bring him in day two, and it's like this guy, he's a developmental guy. He has to get in here and work. And I can see why some of the teams that would have had based on things we heard about the interview, might have had a tough time projecting that. But you could not have asked for a better situation for him. He absolutely fits that Stefanski offense.
I agree.
They have absolutely nothing in that. Yeah, I mean, it's a really, really good fit. The short and intermediate timing concepts there, where they ask you to get the ball out on time, the concept of the play, and then put it on the hands, that's the thing Shedeur is best at. So, again, if he just shows up ready to work, I think they got something cooking there.
Well, it's funny because in the open to the show, I actually mentioned that Stefanski, you know, KOC, you know, McVay, there are a couple of guys, but especially if they can run the football and they can go play action and they can run bootleg and they can just kind of make it easier, not put all of it on him, he'll have a chance, and that was a good spot to sort of end up in. All right, last one. Biggest reach of the draft was who?
I would say Tyleik Williams in the first round from Detroit. We were in an environment where the offensive linemen were being pulled up in the first round and the interior defensive linemen were being pulled up in the first round.
Yep.
And Detroit, a team that we were talking about edges quite a bit earlier in the segment, Detroit was a team that badly needed an edge. You have Aiden Hutchinson coming off an injury. You're going to have to rely on Marcus Davenport, who gets injured every year and has never been anything in the NFL. And there was edges, I thought, that were worthy of that selection. And they might not have been as, we have to get this sort of an edge as Washington was. I was stunned that in the position that they were in, you end up pulling an interior defensive lineman, in my opinion, a round up the board. Tyleik Williams, there's stuff about his game I like for sure. He's a really, really good run defender. But for me, to take an interior defensive lineman in the first round like that, you have to be able to project something of him as a pass rusher. And I just don't know what you're getting there with Tyleik Williams. And as far as an edge, a run stuffing interior defensive lineman, that's a cheap thing to acquire in the NFL. So I wasn't sure. But Brad Holmes, of course, has gone, you know, off the grid before and has been proven right. So I'm going to give him another opportunity to make me look like a fool. I thought that was the biggest reach of the draft.
I'm sorry, one last question. Who's the top pick next year in the draft? Is it Arch Manning?
If he declares, that's going to be fascinating. You know, obviously the two other Mannings prior to him, the two most recent that we've seen, stayed all 4 years, and that was prior to the NIL era. And
right.
Also with Arch, we haven't – the amount of snaps he took in the first 2 years – not very many, right? Because Quinn Ewers was there. So that's a tough one. Will he be in the draft or not? I think, you know, you look at other guys, if he doesn't declare, Drew Allar probably would be way up there, you know, as far as quarterbacks. We have a better offensive tackle class next year. I think it's going to be a better class overall. So, yeah, but we are on Manning watch. I mean, for the next calendar year, that's going to be all the Manny is going to have to field that question a lot about if he is going to consider declaring for the draft after the season.
You're the best. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for the time. Great work on the draft. And, you know, take a couple of weeks off. What do you do when it's over?
Sleep.
Well, get some sleep and get back at it soon. Thanks, Thor.
Always good talking to you, Kevin.
Thor Nystrom, everybody. He's actually really, really good. Went on for a while, but really thought it was some good information. Again, it's the draft. Who really knows? But the post-draft power rankings are out, and our team's getting a ton of respect. More on that next.
All right, last night, the Washington Capitals closed out the Montreal Canadiens by a score of 4-1. Alex Ovechkin netted his 40th career playoff power play goal. Logan Thompson saved 28 out of 29 shots, posting a .966 save percentage. They will face Carolina in round two. Last night, a Pittsburgh Pirates fan fell 21 feet over the Roberto Clemente wall and onto the warning track. Umpires called a halt to the contest while EMS and training staff tended to him as players looked visibly shaken. He remains in critical condition at Allegheny General Hospital. The Timberwolves beat the Lakers last night to close out their series 103-96. Rudy Gobert had 27 points, 24 rebounds, and 2 blocks. They will face the winner of Warriors-Rockets. And last night, the Nats fell to the Phillies 7-2. Jake Irvin pitched 6 innings, gave up 8 hits and 6 earned runs. The Nats dropped to 13-8. They continue their series tonight on 106.7 The Fan. This update is sponsored by the Team 980 YouTube page. Just open the app, type in the Team 980, and hit subscribe. Kevin Sheehan is live from 10 to 1 and Craig Hoffman from 4 to 7. Don't forget to like the stream and turn on notifications to stay up to date on all things DC sports. And that's what's trending.
Podcasting isn't just evolving. It's having a full-blown identity crisis. I'm Allison Marino, host of What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined, a new series that pulls back the curtain on the forces shaping the medium now and what that means for all of us who love podcasts. I'm really excited to share the official trailer where you'll hear from some of the biggest names in the space. Ira Glass, Leo Laporte, Guy Raz, Hernan Lopez, Lex Friedman, AJ Feliciano, Dan Granger, and yeah, me too. Here it is now.
I still want to kill the word podcast.
That's not just a hot take. It's a symptom of an identity crisis.
Big company run media, and people are trusting it less and less. It's really important that we're independent.
There's a handful of companies that control the vast majority of podcast inventory that have the vast majority of the gigantic shows.
We left radio behind for a reason. We wanted to get away from all the gatekeepers.
I don't know that you could do this as effectively in video.
Podcasting is at a crossroads. I've watched the industry swing from hype to consolidation to reinvention. But this time it's different. From the producers of the documentary Age of Audio, Oxford Road presents the Media Roundtable special series. What's a podcast? The Revolution Redefined.
All of us who work in the media, like, yeah, we got to run a business and like, we got to make a living and we got to sell our ads and we got to do all that. But we all got into it because like, I think most of us, like, it just gave us a feeling.
A 3-part series where you'll hear the leading industry voices give their takes on what podcasting has become and where it's headed next. Teaming up with Oxford Road and Age of Audio director Sean Colon for this series was fun, but also kind of a wake-up call. If you love this medium as much as I do, you've got to listen to What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined. It's out now, wherever you get your podcasts.